Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last June, Jeff Kosicki, the director of the San Francisco Department of Homelessness, joined us to talk about his new role at the new department. He said his top priorities were to take all of the programs run by the city and nonprofits and operate them under one umbrella. He said it doesn't make sense for homeless people to stand in multiple lines, sign up on multiple waiting lists to get services, be assessed 15 different times by 15 different case managers, for example. He said those services need to be streamlined. That way, service providers can track an individual or a family to ensure that they're getting the appropriate resources. At the time, he said that currently does not exist. Well, Jeff Kosicki is here today to talk about and give us an update on that. Last year, when Mayor Ed Lee announced plans to launch a new city department to permanently end homelessness, the goal was to get at least 8,000 individuals off the streets by the year 2020. The department opened in August and has an annual budget of about $220 million. Mayor Lee's Prop K would have added an additional $50 million to expand homeless services, but that did not pass during the November election. Today, Jeff Kosicki joins us to talk about what has changed since he's become director of this new department. Before taking the job, Jeff served as executive director of Hamilton Families and the Community Housing Partnership. And Jeff joins me in studio. Hi, Jeff. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nice to have you. Well, before the show, I was telling you that a couple of years ago, I spent about 6 months doing an investigation looking at older homeless women and the challenges they face. And I spent a lot of time in shelters, walked around with them in the city. And as you have said, people who don't know someone homeless or haven't spent much time with homeless people don't know how difficult it is to get the different services that they need. And when you were on our show last June, you said that it's not atypical for people to be assessed 15 different times by 15 different case managers, to stand in multiple lines, to travel across the city. It takes time. And if you're an older woman, homeless person, that's really difficult, especially if you have a health condition. So you said that those services need to be streamlined. Give us an update. How are you doing on that?
Yeah, thank you for that question. We're very excited to announce that the city has begun the process of streamlining all of those services. We're starting with a data system, which is called, we're calling the One System, the Online Navigation and Entry System. And how that will work is as soon as someone touches the services system, they will be assessed. They will only need to be assessed once, and they will be matched to the appropriate service for them. And this way, we'll be able to prioritize people into housing, those who are the sickest and the longest-term homeless, like many of the people that you probably spoke to during your story that you were working on. And we'll be able to really then tell folks what's going to happen next with them. Anytime they speak to a case manager, that case manager is going to be able to know the history of that person's service provision. And I think that's going to go a long way to providing a much better system of care for homeless people in San Francisco.
What tangible changes have you seen as a result of this?
Well, we haven't started it yet. This problem's been 40 years in the making. We're not going to solve it overnight. This system is going to be consolidating 15 different databases, none of which currently talk to each other into one. So the first step that we have made is to select the data system. We got great help as well as philanthropic support from a number of companies. We're really happy about that. We're going to be standing up the first phase of this project in late spring, early summer, focusing on family homelessness. Then we'll take on veterans, youth, and ultimately by the end of 2018, the entire system should be up and running under this one system.
And tell us a little bit about this new department that was launched last year. A lot of people didn't realize that the city of San Francisco didn't have a department of homelessness. At the time, Mayor Ed Lee said his goal was to get about 8,000 people off the streets by 2020. The department opened officially in August, has an annual budget of about $220 million. Here we are in January. Describe what the last 6 months has been like.
Well, you're trying to stand up this new department. I think one of our main focuses has been developing a new strategic plan around homelessness for the city. There had been the 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness. That plan expired quite a few years ago, I believe, 2 or 3 years ago. And we're working on a new plan that really looks at each subpopulation of homeless people, families, youth, chronically homeless single adults, veterans, et cetera, figuring out where there's gaps in the system. We'll be providing a report of what those gaps are and how much it would cost to fill those gaps, but also setting goals, specific goals for each population. For example, we have the goal of reducing the average time that a family is homeless from currently it's about 15 months down to 90 days by 2020. And we have a goal of ending chronic veterans homelessness by Veterans Day of 2017. We're working on exactly what our goals are around encampments and street homelessness, chronically homelessness, and youth homeless. But we'll have that available in just a few months and are really excited. And a lot of our work has been around that, around standing up this data system and also bringing together people, money, and programs from five different departments into one, which in itself is a challenge, bringing on new leadership staff, changing the culture or building a new culture that really is focused on being data-driven, on outcomes, and on really celebrating every single person who we help exit homelessness, and then also feeling that urgency that every person that we're not able to help is how are we going to do that.
You come to this job with a lot of experience. You served as executive director of Hamilton Families and the Community Housing Partnership. One of the things that struck me when I did my reporting is when I would walk into a shelter or talk to people, they would say, you know what, we are sick of officials coming here and talking to us and putting reports together, and then nothing ever comes of it. These were homeless people who said, we've been on the streets, we know that these reports are done, these people in suits talk with us, and we don't see changes. Some of the people that I interviewed who used to be homeless, who are now housed, say that they're frustrated because they feel like they don't have a seat at the table. And they said if city officials really want to solve this, they would give us the jobs to solve this issue because we've been there. So are you bringing people who are homeless or formerly homeless into this department?
So what we have done, well, first of all, I should say, we're not really bringing that many new people into the department. We have taken staff from various other departments and brought them together into one department. But I will tell you that quite a few members of our HOT team are formerly homeless. Many of the leadership staff and the line staff of the nonprofits who we fund are formerly homeless. I should also add that we've done well over 1,000 surveys and interviews with people who are formerly homeless in the process of standing up the department and creating the strategic plan. So the voice of people who are experiencing homelessness is certainly going to be heard. Having a voice at the table or a seat at the table as we're doing our planning is certainly part of our culture, and I think it has been in the city. The local homeless coordinating board, for example, the body that oversees our federal funding, has a number of people who are formerly homeless on that body. So we'll certainly continue to hear those voices, hopefully be able to amplify them and address some of the concerns that we're hearing from people who are have experienced this issue or are experiencing it right now.
And can you tell us about the HOT team? What do they do?
Sure. The HOT team is many people have probably seen the HOT team around town with their jackets on and interacting with people on the streets. They have a number of different jobs. One is to do outreach to the hardest to serve homeless population, to develop relationships with them, find out what their needs are, figure out how to get them into shelter or into housing. We also have a case management branch of the HOT team. They're working with very challenging individuals who have complex mental or physical health conditions and working with them to get them into housing, and once they get into housing, to help them get stabilized and to get the care that they need to move on to better things in their lives. They also do respond to complaints that we get from neighbors about someone having a challenge on the street, maybe somebody yelling on the street or somebody sleeping on a doorway. The HOT team will go out on their own or sometimes with the police to try to help that person move to a better space and to address whatever their immediate crisis is.
Now, every person who doesn't have a home has a completely different story, and everybody has a story. What are you hearing from people who were formerly homeless about what they want this department to prioritize?
So it's interesting. I mean, I think the two things that we heard loud and clear, no matter who we speak to, is one, more housing. And number two is a system that makes more sense, that they don't have to stand in multiple lines, that they don't have to guess what's going to happen next to them. You know, many people who experiencing homelessness have experienced and are experiencing trauma. And one thing that we try to practice in our case management is trauma-informed care. And a big tenet around trauma-informed care is that people need to know what's going to happen to them next. So we hope that not only will our case management be trauma-informed, our entire system will be trauma-informed. And anytime a staff person, a city staff person, or a nonprofit staff person encounters somebody on the streets, once our data system is up and running, we'll be able to give that person answers. And it may not be the answer they want to hear, like that there's no housing available right now or there's no shelter available, but at least people will know what's going on and be able to make decisions for themselves based on having that information.
Now, this is not surprising, but every time we have a homeless advocate on, he or she says that housing is the solution. Last year, Governor Jerry Brown signed a state budget that directs $3.6 billion in state and federal funds to affordable housing and homelessness programs. On Tuesday, he came out with his budget. Obviously, it still has to be looked at, and the final budget will be done this summer, so we're not sure what it will include in terms of affordable housing funds. How much of that money did San Francisco get and put toward homeless services and trying to find housing for people?
Yeah, so I agree. I mean, housing is absolutely the answer. And it's a very big struggle when the HUD budget is about 20% of what it was in 1978. And we spend over twice as much on the mortgage interest tax deduction than we do on subsidizing affordable housing in this country. So it is a very big challenge. And anything that the state and local government can do is certainly appreciated. But it's important to understand this is very much a federal issue that really needs to be addressed if we're ever going to deal with housing instability and homelessness. As far as what the governor recently has done, there's a new program called No Place Like Home that puts $2 billion of new funding for affordable housing, specifically for homeless people who are having mental health challenges, the chronically homeless primarily. We don't know how much San Francisco is going to get of that, but I anticipate it will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million at least, and that funding will be used to build new housing, the kind of housing we build, a community housing partnership and many other organizations have built that are serving chronically homeless individuals who many people think, well, this person can't be housed, but successfully are housing people who are on the street right now. And we're excited to be able to build, we'll hopefully be able to build four or five new projects by leveraging that state money with local money and with private investments.
I'd like to talk about those projects in just a minute, but I think what you said about HUD is really important because Paul Bowden, who you know, the organizing director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, he used to be homeless and now he runs this organization. And anytime he's on the show, he says, people need to learn about HUD. He said, it's not what has to happen is the solutions need to come from the federal government. This cannot happen really at the city level because we just don't have the funding for it. Before we talk about Ben Carson, whose hearing is happening right now, and he might be leading HUD, it's a $49 billion. They have a $49 billion budget, 8,300 employees. Can you please give us a little bit of history about how HUD was completely gutted in the 80s?
Well, actually, it was
70s and the 80s.
It was in 1978 this process began, and HUD, which once was always building and subsidizing new housing, new affordable housing for low-income communities, really stopped doing that, stopped building new housing, eliminated a lot of their new construction programs. Those programs were replaced by a program that's now run by the IRS, which I find to be very ironic that our biggest housing program in the United States for low-income folks is run by the IRS and not by HUD.
Why was that decision made?
That was made, I believe there were, you know, that the Reagan administration had a certain philosophical bent towards the private market and that providing low-income housing tax credits was a replacement to what had been direct investments by the federal government. That program, while it has produced tens of thousands of units around the country and is an important program, is also inefficient. It relies on the private market. So, for example, if the Trump administration lowers the corporate tax rate, those tax credits become much less valuable to the investors and will I expect there'll be a reduction of 10 to 15% just in the value of that program because the credits won't be worth as much if the corporate tax level goes down. So it's really we need to have this direct investment. I mean, I learned a lot of this from Paul Bowden, who is a friend and mentor of mine. Mm. And fully agree that if we're ever going to really solve homelessness and housing instability in the U.S., it needs to be solved and addressed at the federal level. But that's not to say we can't and shouldn't do more at the state and local level.
What are your thoughts about Ben Carson? His hearing is happening as we speak, and ABC has a story. Carson vows to advocate for HUD funding and confirmation hearing. I mean, they always say that they're going to do what most of the politicians want them to do. Who knows what he's going to do? But what are your thoughts on this?
I don't really know that much about Dr. Carson. I can only hope that he will continue on the path that HUD has been on really since George Bush was president. And starting to focus on homelessness. You know, we have actually – HUD has done a very good job, in my opinion, around homelessness. They have not done a great job around affordable housing. But on this smaller and I think easier to digest issue and frankly doesn't require as much funding, investments have been made. Good strategies have been put in place. Many of those strategies were pioneered here in San Francisco. The focus on housing first, the use of rapid rehousing subsidies, a lot of that was pioneered in San Francisco. And we've been happy with the direction that HUD has been taking, again, starting with President Bush. And I can only hope that Ben Carson and President-elect Trump are going to follow in those footsteps and continue to invest in programs that we know work and continue what we've seen nationally, which has been a reduction in homelessness in the entire country.
And what we're going to do over the next 4 years is we're going to talk a lot about solutions and what needs to change, even if we might not see that change in 4 years. But in terms of HUD effectively dealing with the affordable housing crisis across the country, what changes could happen?
I think there just needs to be a reinvestment in the Section 8 program now called Housing Choice Vouchers, reinvestment in public housing. The construction of more affordable housing needs to be funded. I think we need to look at new revenue sources. I think we need to think about why our mortgage interest tax deduction continues when it only serves about a third of Americans, most of whom are upper income. And all praise to Assemblyman David Chu for putting forward a piece of legislation that will end the mortgage interest tax deduction for people who have second homes or third homes or fourth homes in California, generating money to address homelessness and supportive housing. I hope that this will move forward and that California will again lead the way for the rest of the country on how we need to address housing and homelessness.
He just introduced that legislation.
Yes, it was.
All right. Well, if you agree with that, you might want to make a phone call to your assembly member or your senator. Today, we're joined by Jeff Kaczynski. He's director of the San Francisco Department of Homelessness. He took this job last August. It was officially launched then when Mayor Ed Lee announced plans to launch this new department. He said he wanted to get 8,000 people off of the streets by the year 2020. This department has an annual budget of $220 million. And before he took that job, Jeff Kaczynski was executive director of Hamilton Families and Community Housing Partnership. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a question or comment for Jeff Kaczynski, what would you like to ask him? If you work on these issues, a nonprofit with that works to get people off of the streets and help them with services and affordable housing, what changes have you seen over the past 6 months? If you've ever experienced homelessness, what do the priorities need to be? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, we'd love to hear from you. You can also leave a comment on our Facebook page or Twitter. And let's hear from Mark in the Mission. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say that walking down the street in San Francisco downtown, especially at night, it's shocking to see in every doorway, there's somebody sleeping. And it makes me wonder, you know, how do we do this? How do we do this in our city, in our society? You know, how do people just not see that or not care about that? And I include myself in that problem. I don't know what to do. And I was hoping to ask the guest, what sort of volunteer opportunities are available does he think and would be most effective?
Thank you. That's a great question. There's so many great nonprofit organizations that need volunteers, GLIDE, St. Anthony's, so many others. A great place to start would be with Project Homeless Connect, which was a program that was started by then-Mayor Newsom, which brings together volunteers from around the community together with homeless people to provide services, to get to know one another. They have not only the big events that occur once a quarter, but they also have something called Everyday Connect, where volunteers speak with homeless people and help them navigate the services system and provide them access to some basic things that they might need, like socks and access to food, those sorts of things. That's a good place to start, and they can also direct you if what they're doing isn't really speaking to you personally or to someone personally. They can direct you to other places where you can volunteer. But this problem, again, took 40 years to get to where we are. It's not going to be solved by one city, one department, one person. Volunteers are a critical part in helping address the problem. So thanks for that question.
Yeah, thank you for calling in, Mark. To his point about seeing people in doorways, I mean, we all see this. BART, for example, the PAL BART station, there's so many people there now. You know, talking to cab drivers, they've got stories. Talking to people who are just visiting, they're shocked at this. How do you answer that question when people say, how could this be happening in a city like San Francisco?
Yeah, it's a complicated question, and a lot of what I start with is what the country has as its current housing policy and how that has led to the rise of modern homelessness. But I also like to remind people that everybody we see is somebody's son, somebody's daughter, somebody's brother or sister. They're members of our community. We should not look past them. We should look at them, engage with them, talk to them, see them, or at the very least smile at them, because it's very easy to look at this and to not want to see it. It causes despair. It causes me despair. Every homeless person I see on the street, it, you know, really breaks my heart a little bit. And we all need to, at the very least, make sure that we recognize that these are our community members and we should treat them as such.
There's also a lot of misperceptions out there about homeless people. According to the city's 2015 homeless count, 71% of the people on the streets were living in San Francisco when they lost their housing. That got a lot of attention when that came out.
Yes, that is correct. There's often been this discussion that, you know, homeless people come to San Francisco to get services. There's no real data that backs that up. But I will say the fact that 30% of the folks came from somewhere else is something for us to think about. And it really is wanting me to focus on and our department to focus on a regional solution to homelessness. We're starting conversations with the counties that surround us. Many of them are going to be using the same data system that we use, so it will create an opportunity for us to share data across the region to really better understand the problem and to work together, because what you'll see in the point in time count is that most of the counties around us have the same experience. They've got about 30% of the homeless population having come from somewhere else. People who are poor and desperate don't think about the geopolitical boundaries that we've established. They're worried about where they are going to sleep that night, how they're going to get some food, and people do move, just like, you know, the rest of, just like the house population. People move around.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Petaluma, and when I go back to visit family, it's shocking to see people standing where there's a stop sign or a stoplight or at the grocery store. I mean, I've never seen so many people with signs asking for money before.
Yeah, it's a whereas homelessness has decreased in the United States, it's actually increased on the West Coast fairly dramatically. And part of the reason that is because the West Coast is where a lot of the country's economy is. San Francisco, Silicon Valley were, you know, one of the major centers of the economic world. And people come looking for opportunity. It's very expensive to be here, and sometimes things don't work out and they end up on the street. But we're seeing this, you know, all over California, Portland, and Washington State. That's one of the reasons why Mayor Lee recently convened a meeting of all of the West Coast mayors, where we put together an agenda that was presented to members of Congress to talk about what we felt were the needed to be the priorities around addressing this problem, which is really growing in the West Coast while we're seeing it being reduced in other places around the country.
Jeff Kaczynski is director of the San Francisco Department of Homelessness. This department was created last year by Mayor Ed Lee. He said he wanted to get 8,000 people off of the streets by the year 2020. The department has an annual budget of about $220 million. If you have any questions or comments for Jeff Kaczynski about homelessness in San Francisco, we'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you prefer to write rather than call, you may email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of Iranian President Hashemi Rafsanjani's legacy. He passed away on January 8th. We will also look at coverage of this week's confirmation hearings, Donald Trump's conflicts of interests, and his hostility toward journalists and media organizations. How should journalists cover all of this and protect the freedom of the press? That is tomorrow. And then we're starting a new Book of the Month Club, and we're kicking it off with No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. It's by labor activist Jane McAlevey, and she'll be joining us on January 24th. So we hope you can grab a copy of her book and then join us with your views and questions. And if you have a show idea or an author idea, we'd love to hear from you. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Jeff Kaczynski, director of the San Francisco Department of Homelessness. This is a new role that he took back in August when Mayor Ed Lee announced plans to launch this department. He said he wanted to get 8,000 people off of the streets by 2020, and this department has a budget of about $220 million a year. So if you have any questions or comments for Jeff Kaczynski, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you work on these issues, if you're a concerned citizen, you can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose and Mr. Kaczynski. The problem with bureaucracies is that they are self-perpetuating. They are not interested in solving problems. They are interested in continuing their paychecks. And that's the problem in San Francisco with the homeless problem. Using your figures, Rose, if $220 million is being spent on the homeless problem every year, and I don't think that figure is new. I think it's been approximately that amount of money for quite some time. And there are 8,000 people who are homeless in San Francisco. That's $25,000 per person being spent on the homeless problem. The idea that that cannot get people off the street. Now, I'm not talking about solving the homeless problem entirely, but getting a significant reduction in the homeless problem is ridiculous. Mr. Kaczynski has been part of that problem. He has been part of the system for years and years and years, so I have very little confidence that he's going to be solving the problem now. So I have two questions. First, since we're streamlining the homeless problem, homeless bureaucracy, how many people are going to be out of jobs? How many bureaucrats are going to be reduced in the new system? And the fact that it's going to take until 2018 to get this new system up and running is ridiculous. But how many people are going to be reduced from the bureaucracy through this so-called streamlining position? Secondly, there is a gentleman, an old man living in ragged, dirty clothes at 5th and Mission Street in the bus stop. people have been calling about him, trying to get him help for months and months and months. If Mr. Kavinsky doesn't know about this gentleman, all he has to do is go down to Fifth and Mission, and there he is. And each time the homeless outreach people go down there and try to help them, he refuses their help, and so he just stays there. What can we do about helping this man who obviously needs some assistance?
Thanks, John.
Well, there was a lot of information and questions in that call, so let me start with the first comment around the budget. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why it's very difficult to get to solutions to homelessness anywhere is sort of a lack of understanding and a lack of really dealing with the facts. So, yes, our budget is $220 million a year, but let's break that down. We serve about 14,000 individuals a year through our shelter and other services systems. So that's 14,000 folks that are being served that way. In addition to those 14,000, there's another 8,000 people who we're housing with those funds. So over almost half of our budget, over half, $120 million approximately, is actually being spent on housing people who used to be homeless, most of whom have some type of disabling condition. About $40 million of our budget is spent on medical services for folks who would need them whether or not they were homeless. That leaves us with about $50 or $60 million to serve about 14,000 people a year who are coming through this system who need shelter, food, and other types of services. So we're not spending $25,000 a year on each homeless person. Frankly, I wish that we would, because if we were, we'd be able to house all of them.
And before we move on to the other question, Prop K would have added an additional $50 million to this budget, but that did not pass in November.
That is correct.
Can you talk about what Prop K would have done and what would you have done with that $50 million? Why do you think it didn't pass?
You know, I'm not sure why it didn't pass. I think it's interesting that the voters, two-thirds of the voters, voted yes on Prop J, which was the companion piece, which would have allocated the funding for homelessness and for transportation. Prop K simply said, would you like to raise the sales tax by 0.75%. It was without knowing that was necessarily connected to homelessness and transportation. I think a lot of voters got confused. There were many things on the ballot, many revenue measures on the ballot. And I'm very disappointed that K didn't pass, but was heartened that J got two-thirds of the vote, that S got almost two-thirds of the vote, which is around homeless families. Clearly, people want more services, and clearly many people have believed that the city can deliver them. Unfortunately, K did not pass, and that did put a hole in our budget. The mayor engaged in some rebalancing of the budgets in December, and effectively was able to restore some of the funding that was cut. We now have a gap of about $6 million over what we would have had if Prop K would have passed. For next fiscal year, our gap is about $30 million. So most of what we're not going to be able to fund are new housing programs, new housing subsidies. We did manage to restore some funding to continue adding more navigation centers and to make sure that all of the programs that are currently housing and sheltering people don't go away, because we certainly don't want any of the programs that we have that are currently assisting folks to be reduced in any way, because that's just going to add to the problem.
And what can people do? For example, John just brought up an example of a man he sees on Fifth and Mission, and when people call to get help, the man refuses the help.
Yeah, that's a very difficult issue. I'm sure, as he had indicated, the HOT team has been out and spoke to this person. I actually believe that I know the gentleman that he is speaking of. And it is really challenging, because people like that, and it oftentimes, you know, need to be conserved. They're not making decisions. We don't have a legal right to make somebody go where they don't want to go. In order for us to be able to say, you need to get help, you need to be in the hospital, you need to be in a housing against somebody's will, they need to be conserved. And in this country, we have something called the Constitution, and that provides people with individual rights, and they sometimes it becomes very difficult. I mean, I struggle with this. I do feel strongly that individuals have right to self-determination, but sometimes mental illness or substance abuse makes it difficult for people to exercise those rights in a way that you or I might think makes sense, but it's not for you or I to decide. It's for the courts to decide. That's the system that we have in this country. And although sometimes it does create challenges, it's also, I think, fundamental to who we are as a people.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, John. Let's go next to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Go ahead. So, you're on the air.
Great. Yeah, my question is, you know, I think a lot of us were really disappointed to see Prop Q passed. And, you know, we kind of don't like the idea of having our homeless population kind of pushed around on the streets. And, you know, you mentioned earlier this idea of, you know, kind of homelessness being experienced in different ways up and down the coast of the West Coast. A lot of other cities like Seattle and Portland have taken some pretty innovative solutions, like, for instance, Opportunity Village and Dignity Village, which, you know, collaborates with the city to provide services. And I'm just wondering what San Francisco position is, because it seems like a real opportunity to provide an innovative solution by using, you know, kind of a village approach and using underutilized land. I'm wondering if the Department of Homelessness has considered these options and what their stance is on that.
Well, thank you. And for people who don't remember or don't know, Prop Q was the tent ban, which did pass in November.
So the question around – so Opportunity Village is a sanctioned tent encampment essentially that exists. They're in Portland. There's a few in Seattle. There's some in Hawaii that take underutilized land and allow people to set up tent encampments or build small box homes where they can stay and self-manage those sites. The city and county of San Francisco has taken a slightly different approach, which is to use that type of land to build navigation centers where the conditions are much better. They're drier. They're safer. They're indoors. Generally improve the neighborhoods that they're in, both physically and from a public safety perspective, and also provide people with the level of services that they need to move on to something else, to get into our Homeward Bound program, to get a rent subsidy, to get into housing. And that's the policy direction that the city has taken prior to me taking the job, but it's one that I strongly believe in and think that we do need to, while we're trying to build more housing, we have to have meanwhile solutions. There needs to be a place for people to go to get off the streets, to be able to sleep indoors instead of in tents on our streets. And the navigation centers is center to that strategy, as well as we're hoping that we'll also be able to open up another resource center. I think we need more places in the city for people who are homeless to be able to go to during the day to charge their cell phones, take a shower. So we've had those in the past before in San Francisco. Unfortunately, many years ago, two large resource centers were closed, and we're hoping to rebuild that system because we do need meanwhile solutions. People shouldn't be on the streets in the rain. Neighbors shouldn't have to have 50 tents set up in front of their homes or around their businesses. And but again, navigation centers and resources, I think, is the way we're going to go, rather than sanctioning tent encampments, because that's really sanctioning something that none of us think is the right solution.
You probably know the Coalition on Homelessness posted a photo of a large tractor getting rid of what looks like some sort of wooden structure along with people's belongings. And it says that in the downpour and the storm, city officials cleared Box City at 7 a.m. on January 10th. This encampment is made up of men and women who are mostly Filipinos. City workers threw belongings into dumpsters. They crushed boxes that were once people's homes. The city has destroyed Box City without offering anything except 30 days in the navigation shelter, with little to no chance of getting housing afterwards. One person said 30 days is not enough time for me to get help. I can't even get my belongings over there. Can you talk about how are these decisions made to bring these tractors in to get rid of these tents?
So let's talk about Box City. We were discussing that a little bit before the program started, and it's one of be clear about what happens around how we address encampments. We make the decisions about which encampments to address based on a number of factors. One is how big they are, how dangerous they are, based on observations from our staff and public works and the police, and the number of complaints that we receive around those specific encampments. And to be clear, for us, encampments are six tents or more that have been there for a month or longer. We have done this in Islas Creek and then at three sites in the Mission. To date, we've helped 190 people who were in those encampments move to navigation centers or shelters. We've helped move 190 people remove those tents and those encampments. And of those 190, 105 ended up in navigation centers, shelters, or housing. And Box City, and we got some criticism for moving it during the rain. And my answer was, like, why wouldn't we move that in the rain? Like, why would, when it's raining and the weather is so terrible, why wouldn't we take people who are currently living in boxes and tents and literally surrounded by a river of feces and needles and garbage? Why wouldn't we move those folks while it was raining? It was the rain made it more urgent that we address that encampment and we get those people indoors from Box City. There were 45 people that were there. There were 45 structures that were there and about 40 people. There were a number of people who told us that they only come there sometimes to party. There, 30 of them were moved to navigation centers. Five went back to family members or reconnected with friends. 10 kind of wandered off, and we don't know where they went. But I'm really proud of those numbers. I'm glad that we were able to help 30 of those residents sleep indoors tonight. I'm proud that we were able to help the neighbors who lived around that get some relief from the crime and from the noise and from all of the public health problems that were being created by that site. This is we need to be compassionate for everybody in the city, both people who are homeless, but also people who are impacted by these large-scale encampments. These aren't sweeps. This took us about a month to do. It involved meetings with people who lived there. It involved assessments of every single individual who was there. And we did it slowly because we only did it at the pace through which we had shelter available and space available for those folks.
So just to be clear, because when these photos are posted on Facebook, people get really angry. So you actually went to this place and people were told that this was going to happen?
Yes, about a month in advance.
Okay, because obviously it looks awful. There's a tractor, things are crushed, they're thrown in the dumpster. I mean, it looks
so
like...
Let me also be really clear about that. Everybody was asked, do you want to keep your box that you've built? A lot of people had built these nice boxes. Mm-hmm. Do you want to keep them or not? Only 10 said yes. Those have all been stored.
So it's not like you're coming in with a tractor and saying,
no,
get out because we're going to smash all your stuff and we're going to throw it away, because that's what it looks like in these photos.
No, people are given a choice about how much of their – what they want to keep and what they don't want to keep. A lot of people tell me they accumulate garbage in order to sort of build a protective wall around themselves or to hide their actual possessions. You know, so the more stuff people see, the less someone's going to come and root through it because, you know, in there is probably somebody's really valuable personal possessions. You know, did it go perfectly? You know, I don't think so. Was it done with coming from a place of compassion and respect for people's personal property and their individual rights? You know, absolutely. But it was also done with respect for the law, which states that it's illegal to set up a dwelling unit on our sidewalks, and respect for the rights of people who are housed and impacted by this. It's far from a perfect system. You know, we need thousands of more shelter beds. We're really limited by the space that we have, but we're driven by we're limited by the number of beds we have, but we're driven by our compassion and our unwillingness to just move people from a community like that without telling them we have somewhere else for them to go. Also want to be clear about the navigation center. We've turned one of the navigation centers into more of a triage center with a shorter stay. But once you're in there, what the staff are trying to do is to get you into one of the other nav centers or to get you into shelter or to get you into housing. We're just trying to do it at a much faster pace because we need a place a staging area, if you will, a triage area, and that's how we're using that particular nav center. Now, we're opening up a new facility, which will have up to 150 beds that will be a triage center, and that nav center will return back to operating the way the other nav centers do. But given the encampment crisis in the city, we decided to use this resource in this manner, and so far it's been very successful.
And how long can people stay in these navigation centers once they're moved from a camp into a navigation center?
So again, differentiating between a triage center, which is essentially what we're using 1950 as a triage navigation center. The other navigation centers, the one that we're opening up in the Dog Patch and the one that is on 12th Street, people stay there until we are able to find them housing. Those navigation centers are for people who are our highest priority clients, people who are the longest term homeless, who are the sickest. There's a lot of seniors there, a lot of people with really complex medical conditions. They will stay there until we're able to get them housing. People who are at 1950 right now that have been in encampments, 1950 Mission, I apologize, those folks are being triaged. Like, yes, you are a very high priority client given your substance abuse issue or whatever it is that issue is, we're going to get you matched up with the right service. But we're not guaranteeing that people can stay at that site because, frankly, we need to move on to the next encampment and we need more space. And we have, 4,500 homeless people on the streets, but we only have about 1,200 or 1,300 shelter beds for navigation center beds for single adults.
Wow. Is that going to change anytime soon?
I sure hope so. It's the one thing that I think we really need to focus on is the meantime solutions. In my heart, I've been working on supportive housing and housing for many, many years, and I do know that it is the solution to homelessness, that we need to have more housing, but we have to have meantime solutions. San Francisco has 6,200 units of permanent supportive housing for formerly homeless people, more per capita than any other city in the country. We've done an amazing job. We've helped 23,000 people exit homelessness since 2004 as a city, either through our housing or through rent subsidies or through the Homeward Bound program. But we have to deal with these meantime problems, and I think more navigation centers, which essentially serve as shelters, more navigation centers and resource centers.
Christine wanted to know, what about providing more public toilets? This is getting a lot more attention. I understand a college student had some sort of project and put out a petition, and it's been signed by tens of thousands of people to put more public toilets out on the streets.
I haven't seen that petition, but I would love to just know about that and what that person is thinking. Mm-hmm. So feel free to send it my way. I do think that, again, we need to find meantime solutions. One of the things we want to talk about, and I was just speaking with a gentleman, a merchant from the Mission the other day, and talking about keeping public facilities open more to homeless folks, like where we're providing services, like they should always be open. Those bathrooms should be public. We need to try to leverage more what we have, but I think we also do need to find places for people to use the more restrooms. And I think having more resource centers is a great way to do that, because not only do the resource centers provide a place for someone to take care of their hygiene needs and to go to the bathroom, it also gives us a chance to engage them in services and try to get them some other assistance besides just a place to go to the bathroom.
Another caller who couldn't stay on wanted to know what's the best way to refer someone to access services?
I think that if somebody needs shelter, they should call 311. That individual should call 311 and get into our shelter reservation system. That's the best way to do that. Another great way to access services is to drop into one of our resource centers. There's Mission Neighborhood Resource Center and Cap Street. Glide has a resource center. There's Project Everyday Connect, 25 Van Ness Street. There's Mother Brown's in the Bayview. And then there's the Mission MSC South. In south of Market on near Bryant Street. Those are all drop-in centers where people can come, use the restroom, get access to services. Central City Hospitality House on Turk Street. Those are all listed on our website. And also 311 is available of all of those locations.
Again, Prop K did not pass, which would have added an additional $50 million. We're getting a lot of emails about funding. What could you do with more money? I mean, a lot of people say, look, this is one of the wealthiest cities in the country. You can't get a fixer-upper now for less than $1 million. It's so expensive to live here. What could you do with more money?
Right. I mean, as Tim Redmond from 48 Hills and I were talking, it's probably one of the richest cities ever in the history of cities. And we do need more money. So, you know, if we were able to double our budget, for example, we would have, instead of 1,500 shelter beds, we'd have 3,000 shelter beds. And instead of 6,000 units of housing, we would have 13,000 units of housing. And I think these resources are needed. The people who work in these places, by the way, are not there because they want to keep getting a paycheck. Almost, I don't know anybody getting rich off of providing homeless services. These people are salt of the earth who are doing God's work every day, working with people who are desperate and desperately need our help. And it's the line staff worker at a shelter who's pushing a broom around, or the director of the program, or any of my staff. We're all very, very committed to doing this work and would use this money to do what we know works: navigation centers, more housing. And we're looking for other sources. Like, we are not giving up. For example, we just received an additional $3 million from HUD, which will create some new housing subsidy programs as well as new housing for vets. We've received $18 million more through something called the Whole Person Care Program, which is a Medi-Cal waiver program. We're going to apply for additional funding. There are other sources out there. We just got there's some other funding, I think, that's going to be coming down from HUD in the next couple of days. And there are other opportunities. But I think we also need to look at additional local revenue sources as well, because we know what works. We just need to scale it.
Well, and Tim Redmond points out that the $220 million budget is about 2.8% of the city's $8.6 billion budget. How do you sell this to people at a time when they're frustrated, they're angry, there's so much tension, for example, over the tent encampment? Yeah. And, you know, with a lot of people, different kinds of people moving to San Francisco, I see a lot of negative reaction about spending more money. Everyone says, oh, they just want to spend more money. Right. But the fact is, you need more money to solve these issues.
I think we need more money, but we also need to spend that money better. The caller before who was talking about the bureaucracy and expressed some concerns. I mean, one thing I will agree with, and that I always say, is one thing we've done very poorly in San Francisco is to coordinate all of these services, to have them organized in a way where we can ensure accountability, to be organized around this is how much it should cost to provide service X. Mm-hmm. Why is nonprofit over here charging this much, or why is the city agency charging more than this organization, and really lining up and just using data and common sense and good business sense to provide these services. We can absolutely and will do better, but at the end of the day, we know that these services work and we need more funding, and we're just going to keep – I think the other reason why I get frustrated sometimes when I read stories in the media that are not accurate, or when I go to a community meeting and people are not fully aware of the problem, is because until the public really understands the success of the programs, the truth behind the numbers and really what's happening with the problem, we're never really going to get to a solution, because there'll always be people who are skeptical in spending another dollar when they think the $220 million we spend is being wasted.
You had a community meeting in the Mission recently. Are you going to have more community meetings so people can express their views and really learn about how all of this works?
Yes, we're going to at least 3 community meetings a week, probably more than that. I'm going to 3 community meetings a week. My colleague, Randy, who I'm looking at through in the control room, probably goes to that many as well. We're trying to be out in the community as much as we have. We're on social media. I respond a lot to people via Twitter, get lots of emails, and we want to continue getting our message out as much as possible.
Jeff Kaczynski is director of the San Francisco Department of Homelessness. This is a fairly new department. It was just launched back in August. The goal is to try to find 8,000 people with permanent housing by the year 2020, and the department has an annual budget of about $220 million. Jeff, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your phone calls and emails. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of Iranian President Hashemi Rafsanjani's legacy. He passed away on January 8th. We will also look at coverage of this week's confirmation hearings. There were a lot, really important. Also, Donald Trump's conflicts of interest and hostility towards journalists and media organizations. He gave his first press conference yesterday since July. And wow, there were a lot of fireworks, to say the least. How should journalists protect the freedom of the press? That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Thanks to our volunteers, Helena Murphy and Stephanie Purcell. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.